On this episode of Skeptico.
Maybe we need a little bit of that Yankee imperialism mixed into the mix, too, in that, you know, say, oh, ayahuasca, great. I'll go isolate that. Oh, I isolated it right here. It's DMT. I'll figure out a way to crush it down, crank it out. I'll give it to people. And, hey, lo and behold, they have, if not the same experience, a lot of the same kinds of experiences, you know. And
I'll pull you up there.
Okay.
Is that that's a very common trope in stories about ayahuasca, but in fact, ayahuasca is called ayahuasca because of the vine ayahuasca, which is not the tryptamine-containing compound. And
it's the blocker, right? The one that blocks it in your stomach so that it doesn't run through it so that you can process the DMT, right?
Well, correct. Exactly, at a biochemical level. But in fact, you can take ayahuasca without any DMT admixtures and have a similar experience. You know, there's that attitude, there's that pharmacological attitude of taking the constituent chemical, saying, well, that plant works because of the constituent chemical, and not looking at the bigger picture and saying, well, there's a relationship between the human and the plant that they're imbibing.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Today, the use of medicinal plants, in particular what are generally called hallucinogens or psychedelics, in healing. So our guest today has quite a bit of practical experience in the use of these plants, and Simon Green has some really interesting ideas about how we can incorporate that into Western medicine. What are some of the limitations? What are some of the cultural changes we need to do to maybe make that transition a little bit better for all of us? We also talk about how we might look at the spiritual implications of these plants and incorporate them into our spiritual traditions like Christianity, and how we might understand Christian healing inside of this framework. Finally, he has a couple of just amazing stories about being out in the Amazonian jungle and doing healing. So it was really a fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed getting to know Simon and just dipping my toe into this really important and fascinating topic. I hope you enjoy my dialogue with Simon Green. Today we welcome Simon Green to Skeptico. Simon is a healer and the creator of the Quantum Life Bodyworks website. You know, I've heard from Simon a few months ago after he listened to a couple of Skeptico shows, and we started this really interesting dialogue, and I just thought his work with ayahuasca and various medicines, learning from indigenous shamanic masters throughout Central and South America and in Australia, it was just a fascinating topic. And then he's actually published some radio pieces for Australian Broadcasting Company that are really interesting as well. And I just thought this is a topic we talk about a lot on this show, and it'd be interesting to talk to someone who's really in the field trying to do this work. So with that, Simon, thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico, and welcome.
Many thanks, Alex. It's my great pleasure to join you.
Well, you're welcome. It's great to have you on. You know, Simon, I guess where we should start is probably with a background and a bio on you and how you got interested in this work, but also where this work has taken you. You know, in our conversations, I've gotten emails from you from these remote parts of the world where you didn't have internet connection for days. And where has this work taken you?
Well, I had a very varied career prior to beginning this work. I was raised a rice farmer in the Riverina of Australia, and went off to the city, and eventually became an insurance underwriter. And in the 80s, became disillusioned by that upon return to farming because of an accident or an illness within the family. And I realized the artificiality of that environment in the insurance industry. And I wandered around for a good bit doing all sorts of odd tasks. And various experiences of illness, my own in India, led me to a fairly mental state whereby my perception was of communication with dead folk, which was challenging for my worldview, but nonetheless it continued to occur, and I had to work out a manner in which to incorporate that into my world. And that's a long story in and of itself, but eventually, through a very fortuitous sense of synchronicities, I was led to Brazil, where for the first time I encountered Yaxé, which is a similar preparation to ayahuasca, Colombian preparation of ayahuasca. And prior to this, I'd been working as a cure, as a healer, using bodywork techniques that I'd learned along the way, craniosacral and so on. But for the first time, when I encountered Yaxé, I said, wow, I know this place, yeah? This is what I was looking for. And in a somewhat naive way, I pursued that with great enthusiasm, and learning along the way that things weren't as simple nor as beautiful as I imagined. But that's been the guiding principle, if you will, since then, the work. So over the last close to a dozen years of interacting with ayahuasca, Yaxé, and Huachuma particularly, has become the foundation of my work. And in the course of that, have managed to be interviewed by and subsequently produce feature documentaries for the Australian National Radio broadcaster, and that's led me to work with some significant old people, some significant law bosses in various language groups.
Simon, tell us a little bit about some of the interface you've done with some folks from Western science and medicine who have started to show more of an interest. I mean, there's a real upswing of interest in these plants, in these medicines, in psychedelics for some of these treatments, including post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, particularly addiction treatment, which is kind of a strange combination, but that's where it's going. How do you see that movement going? And also, what do you think is the grounding for that interest among practitioners of this? Do they see this as a good thing that Western people, and particularly Western science, is now interested in these plants and these substances?
That's an extremely complex situation, I think, Alex. There's a huge amount of academic work going on now, and specifically in terms of ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is very fashionable, very well known, and there's a huge amount of academic interest, and certainly academics who could speak much more eloquently to that than I. But I think that I know without doubt that there is extraordinary promise for healing. I've seen healings that would be considered miraculous, and for example, certainly a complete cessation, for example, of symptoms of multiple sclerosis was outright denied as a possibility by the medicos. But along with that, as is unfortunately the case, has come a recognition that there's a huge market there, and so ayahuasca tourism has become very large, and there's no surprise that the locals in those contexts have wanted to capitalize upon that, wanted better education for their kids, wanted better lives for themselves, and sought to capitalize on that, because the Yankee dollar is readily available, and that is causing problems. And I, as I've mentioned when we were chatting, I've just come from a conference to try and address some of the issues of potential harm that come from that. And I think that's a dialogue that needs to be had in a really mature and grounded fashion, because I mean, I'd take issue with the word psychedelic and or hallucinogenic in terms of the particular plants that I'm talking, in terms of ayahuasca and quachuma, xapastora, and the mushrooms. I would consider them visionary medicines, and in fact that the curing, the healing comes about as a direct result of a dialogue between the human and the plant that they're ingesting and a myriad other beings that exist around that and that plant.
See, but right there, Simon, it is, I think we're chatting before about the conversation I had with Paraanthropology Journal editor Jack Hunter, who is taking an anthropological approach to saying, okay, as we look at how these extended conscious experiences are happening, how do we really nail down what's happening scientifically? You know, and as you and I were talking about, is it a ritual? Is the ritual doing it? Is it the spiritual doing it? You know, could you do this just as well with a Ouija board? Could you somehow access these spirits or with a psychic or a medium? And it really raises the question of, we're playing around with not only with these substances, but we're playing around with potentially these spirits in a way that we don't really understand. What are we getting into when we do this?
Well, I think, you know, we get ourselves in many cultural backwaters, you know, and I'm thinking, for example, of all the technologies that we've adopted as in modern Western culture, that we adopt without question, mobile telephones or tobacco, cigarettes, you know, commercial cigarettes, or new chemicals that come onto the marketplace, glyphosate, that are fantastic, and they're going to change everything, and then we discover that they weren't as great as we thought, and we have all of these raft of problems. We're not a thoughtful culture in terms of, let's sit back and ask the questions that you're asking now. But that being said, you know, and I think there's some of that going on in terms of this recent boom in information and interest in these plants. But I think that we're coming into it from a perspective where there is an existent relationship, and we can actually take the historical information that the people who have had a long historical relationship with these plants and use them wisely. I think the big problem is, I mean, I mentioned spirits, and that's a huge stretch for a lot of people and not very scientific in any way. But I think that you can start from the point of the people who know, yeah, who know about these plants in this particular instance, and say, well, you say it's that. Okay, we have a cultural difficulty with that, but not to discard that. I mean, a lot of what occurs in terms of meeting with Indigenous practices, well, that, and I think Jack mentioned this in terms of anthropology, this idea that, well, yes, they do that and they have those rituals, but that's clearly absurd, and so that's just their superstition. We don't need to pay any attention to that, and I think that's the thing that we should be paying attention to. You know, if senior custodians of law here in Australia say, don't go into that country, that sickness country, well, rather than just saying, you know, superstition, let's ask why and find out how we can make a common language, how we can make an interface that works so that we can describe those things from our own point of view. I'm very much rejecting of the psychologizing of everything, you know, in terms of, well, they say spirits, for example, but what they mean is some kind of subset of the subconscious or some such, you know. Right. When I say spirits, I mean sentient others.
You know, but let me take the other side of that, because maybe we need a little bit of that Yankee imperialism mixed into the mix too, in that, you know, say, oh, ayahuasca, great, I'll go isolate that. Oh, I isolated it right here. It's DMT. I'll figure out a way to crush it down, crank it out. I'll give it to people. And hey, lo and behold, they have, if not the same experience, a lot of the same kinds of experiences, you know. And
I'll pull you up there.
Okay.
Because that's a, I think, and I'm recalling, this is one of the reasons for my contact with you in the first instance, is that that's a very common trope in stories about ayahuasca. But in fact, ayahuasca is called ayahuasca because of the vine ayahuasca, which is not the tryptamine containing compound, and
it's the blocker, right? The one that blocks it in your stomach so that it doesn't run through it, so that you can process the DMT, right?
Well, correct, exactly, at a biochemical level. But in fact, you can take ayahuasca without any DMT admixtures and have a similar experience. The visions aren't as bright. Yes, the DMT containing plants gives brightness to the visions, but it's the intelligence of the ayahuasca, of the vine, that plant that contains the MAOI inhibitors, that allows for the oral application of DMT. They're not the same thing. And as you mentioned, Rick, I recall that many of his subjects were extraordinarily confused, by what they encountered, or surprised, to say the least. And I think this is one of those instances where we can say, well, you know, there's that attitude, there's that pharmacological attitude of taking the constituent chemical, saying, well, that plant works because of the constituent chemical, and not looking at the bigger picture and saying, well, it's a relationship. There's a relationship between the human and the plant that they're imbibing. And, you know, we could have gone to those people who have a long-standing relationship with those plants and saying, what do you think about DMT versus MAOI inhibitors? And they might say, well, look, the MAOI, the vine, the ayahuasca, is the intelligence behind the experience, the force, and the chacruna, the DMT containing plant, gives the light to the visions. And we could then have said, well, you know, maybe intravenous DMT injections might be a little bit too much for people. I like to hear what the locals have to say, and that may be a rural Australian character, Alex, but I like to hear what the locals who've been there a long time have to say about what's going on locally, you know.
Oh, no, I'm totally with you, but I do want to push the materialistic, reductionistic kind of approach a little bit. And the reason I do is because I do understand, I guess, a little bit, because I'm so often on the other side of this argument, the side of the argument that you are, that says, look, you guys are full of crap. You don't know what you're doing because you've left consciousness out of the equation and you're hopelessly lost and you're never going to find your way out. The other side of that is somebody who's saying, yeah, but for God's sakes, if we can't measure anything, how are we ever going to move forward? So I can go and talk to one healer who tells me this, and I can go talk to another healer who tells me this, and I can go listen to these traditions here, and I'm going to wind up with a big tangled mess of nothing. Better I go and take my reductionistic pharmacological approach, and I'll just start cranking it out, and I can make a lot of progress there. And I think that Western medicine, if we're going to be honest and objective, has made some unbelievable strides in taking some of these compounds and figuring out a way to mass produce them and distribute them and give them out in proper quantities, you know, figure out how to administer them in an effective way. And there's something to be gained by that. I think that at the same time, I totally respect what you're saying, which is, you know, I always go back to the base question is, how the hell did these people ever know which substances worked for which, you know, for which treatment? And if you go back and you ask them, well, you tell me how they find that out. But I think I know. But
Well, the plants told them, how did you know to make this? And in fact, in that instance, in terms of that particular admixture, one of the stories that I've been told is that, well, how did you know to make, and this goes back to the point of the active component or the active plant, how did you know to mix the DMT containing plant to make the visions brighter? Well, the ayahuasca told us. Well, how did you know about the ayahuasca? Well, tobacco told us about that, you know. But look, I wholeheartedly agree with you in regards to that kind of discernment or methodological approach, or having a look and trying to figure out how things work. And I think that the technologies such as the ones that we're talking about, and I'm talking about a kind of spiritual technology, a cultural technology such that we're discussing, I think they've come about in exactly the same way. Or traditional Chinese medicine, for example, if something works for 3,000 years, and by all measures, Chinese, apart from perhaps social ones, but certainly in terms of, if you take a look at China, it's doing pretty well. If its medical system has lasted that test of time, then there must be something to it. And it's a process of observation, repeated observation, experimental observation, described in a different language to Western science, but one that works nonetheless. And I think the same with these traditions of curanderismo or shamanisms. I don't think there is any such thing as shamanism. But I agree that you can have, if anything goes, then you can have a huge variety of opinions. Well, your illness is caused by sorcery from over there, or your illness is caused because you're disconnected from your twin soul flame in Zeta Reticuli, or some such thing. It has led us to the kind of mess that the New Age is, with no grounding in discernment or methodological approach. So I understand what you're saying, and I think that in answer to your question, I think that we are in a stage where we're going to have to figure that out, as with any introduction of any new technologies, and we're going to need specialists, as we have with every other endeavor in our culture. It's not okay, I don't think, for everybody to be their own shaman, for everybody to be able to heal themselves. People don't have the time to research all of their plants in their environment to be able to heal themselves specifically. That's why we have experts. And I think with regards to this explosion of interest in psychedelic medicines, I think we're likewise going to need experts. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I think it begins to answer it, and I think you're right. I mean, I think that's what I see happening too, just the little bit that I peek into that world, because, you know, I was just watching a medical symposium at University of Pennsylvania that was very top-notch in terms of academic and all that stuff, but it was all about the use of, you don't like the term, but it was psychedelics in clinical work, right? So they weren't coming anywhere close to what you're talking about, Simon, really, in terms of bringing the ritual and some of the deeper wisdom into the thing. But they were trying, you know, they were talking about, you know, setting matters and, you know, certain kind of humanistic kind of qualities matter along with the medicine. So they're kind of getting it. But is that the path forward, do you think? Is it this blending of kind of Western tradition with healing traditions as well? Is that it? Or is that doomed to fail because we're going to leave something out of the sauce that needed to be in there?
I think it's inevitable, Alex. I think it's in terms of environmental issues, and the fact of the matter is that we have invasive species, for example, in Australia. There's no way we're going to put things back to a pre-colonial perspective. And the pre-colonials, the indigenous people, had a incredibly sophisticated land management practices and an incredible variety through an incredible range of cultural expressions, very, very sophisticated ones. So I think that we change things inevitably by acting with them, and there's a very pertinent, you know, 20th century scientific axiom, you know, the observation of the experiment changing it. And I think there's an inevitability. I think that there's more that needs to be done. I mean, clearly I have a bias. Clearly my worldview requires a certain kind of language, yeah? And that's my reality. But it's also a reality that's shared by a great many people around the world. And yeah, I think that we do need to bring the Western endeavor to that in a heartfelt way so that we can make sense of it culturally. I don't think anybody's questioning it in the cultures where these methods of healing, like Nankaris in the central desert, aren't questioning how it is that a malefic spirit causes an illness. Don't need any facts and figures or statistics to tell them that what they know to be true is true. I think our culture is the one that's looking for things. I mean, we're going out and looking for these things and bringing them back and saying, what can we do with this, yeah, this silk from China or whatever. You know, it's the same as it's always been, this expansive kind of cultural process of getting things from elsewhere and trying to integrate them into our culture. But I think heart, for me, is extraordinarily heart and respect for the places that these things come from, and discernment is extremely important. I think some of those people that are working with psychedelic medicines, incredibly intelligent doctors and pharmacologists and so on, have, you know, made huge steps both clinically and culturally in opening up this debate again. But when we're specifically talking about these plant medicines, I think we really need to be careful about how we bring our worldview to those plant usages.
How is your personal experience as a healer kind of inform that opinion? What have you seen out there that reinforces what you're talking about?
It's incontrovertible to me, the evidence, you know, the anecdotal or my personal experience. And it's a daily phenomena, you know, for me. So, you know, I'm moving energetic processes that don't exist from the cultural mind standpoint in the energetic bodies, yes, of a being that then have immediate physical responses, and that's an impossibility from the language that we have to hand at the moment, or certainly from the reductionists, yeah. And so, you know, after a while, one needs to get on with doing life with the understandings that one has, you know. As I said to you earlier, I've seen, for example, I've seen somebody come to a retreat with Yahé and taking 8 to 12 synthetic opioids a day, chronic pain. American doctors had said, we can't do anything other than this. This will be your life now. Yeah. And that woman came in a fog, couldn't remember the trip down because she was in an opiated fog.
Is it a Western woman? I saw her, a Western woman? Or?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, from the United States, and taking OxyContin or something of that nature, yeah, to the level of a stupor, yeah.
Right.
And after 3 sessions with Yahé, I saw her ritually throw those medicines into the ocean, and that's a whole other subject in terms of discarding our water supply into the ocean and our medicines with it. But in that moment, it was an expression of her liberation from that pain. And I spoke with her 6 months down the track, and she hadn't had a return of that pain. I've seen, as I said to you earlier, the complete cessation of symptoms of multiple sclerosis after a sufferer having suffered for a decade from those symptoms. I've seen, and here's a harder perspective to be heard on, but I've seen environmental, physical phenomena responding with great force to events that are, from a Western perspective, purely existing in the psyche of the individuals holding that ceremony. I've seen walls and roofs shaking. I've seen thunderstorms, thunderclouds racing across the landscape stop like a brake was applied. You know, I've seen all manner of phenomena that resist any explanation by our current landscape or our landscape of scientism. I don't believe that there isn't an explanation for those things. But I think here's the issue. I think that the issue is that those phenomena are rejected out of hand, as I mentioned with Jack and the anthropological process earlier. They're just rejected out of hand. Well, that's ridiculous. And I know that you've brought this up a lot. The rejection of actual data. So I'm talking about anecdotal data that's valid. I mean, somebody was asking me something recently about Indigenous Australia and was there any academic papers on this issue? And I said, no, look, my understanding of these things have only come from personal communications from healers. And then I thought, hang on a minute, that describes anthropology. Exactly. Anthropology goes out and asks questions, and sometimes they ask questions of one or two old people who retain the culture, and that then becomes our academic notion of what that culture did. They've asked a couple of people because they're the only people left who knew about those practices, and then that becomes truth. And I think that we should certainly bring that perspective to bear as we approach these things, rather than say, what can we get from that? Well, here's a new medicine. What can we get from that? Thanks very much. We'll take that. I think we need to step quieter and softer and with a great deal more respect than we currently do.
Well, you know, I mean, here's the tough thing. You're not going to get a lot of arguments when you put things that way. But when we really start pulling it apart, it gets messy. You know, we were chatting a little bit in our email exchange about, particularly in Australia, and you say you can see the effect of the colonial wisdom tradition of Christianity, and you know how it just kind of steamrolls over and just obliterates any kind of cultural heritage that people have, and just, you know, it's really hard to take from a anthropological standpoint, you know, to step back and do it. But I put all that out there. Hey, a Christian would come on and tell you they've seen the same thing, and they could probably bring evidence for it in terms of the amazing healing power of Jesus and Christ consciousness and lives transformed and healings done and people that have healed in the name of that spirit. So what do we make of Christian healing? We can't ignore that either.
No, we cannot. And, you know, I agree with you. And we're not going to sort this out by next Tuesday. And I think that's the reason for this discernment and the data collection and so on. So we can have some kind of relatively solid ground to stand on. I mean, the thing that one learns, particularly engaging with master plants from the Americas, is that there isn't really very much solid ground. But from a cultural point of view, yeah, I think we need all of these studies and observations to try and sort wheat from chaff and to work out what's going on. You ask about Christian healing. I have a fairly hard standpoint in terms of Christianity and the mechanisms of the church, the imperialist mechanisms of the church, and I do place the Catholic Church fairly high up on that list of in terms of wrongdoings, yeah. But I had a healing session, a ceremonial process where a harm had been occasioned in the poor use, the ill-advised use, the unritually contained use of ayahuasca. And with another plant mentioned, Wachuma, we entered a ritual space in order to cure that, although the causes weren't specifically available until such time as we entered that space and could bring that particular lens. If you think of these plants as, it seems rude of me to say so, but if you think a good analogy is to think of them as technologies in the same way that, although living technologies, in the same way that we use ultrasounds and MRIs to do diagnostics, a curandero in the Amazon will use ayahuasca as a diagnostic tool and to understand the nature of the illness and then the appropriate medicines in terms of other plants. And it should be mentioned that ayahuasca doesn't exist by itself. There's a whole pharmacopoeia of plants, medicinal plants that go along with that tradition. But in this instance, the curing was affected and the prior wrong righted to a degree. And then there was a visitation from what, to the best of my understanding, the Virgin Mary.
Wow.
Now I'm an outspoken rejecter of the Catholic Church, but there were some 10 people in that ceremonial space. The person who'd had the curing, and another person, and myself, and I was the one running the show. And I pointed out, "Are you aware of what that is?" And the two other people bore witness, so three people bore witness to this event's reality, yes, the others unaware of that. But for the person who'd been sickened by this harm, it was a tremendous healing event. In that instance, post the prior harm, she had subsequently developed a skin cancer on a tear duct and a ongoing and fiercely resistant infection in her jaw. Now, she sought other treatments, obviously, but after that visitation, she had surgical intervention as well, but the root of those illnesses were cured after that event. Now, what kind of causal relationship and temporal relationship those have is an extraordinarily complex situation. But I mean, there you have a situation where this seeming other, this seeming, I don't know if you call the Virgin a deity, but something that I have no cultural relationship to, yeah, I wasn't raised Catholic. The two people who saw, and this is perhaps an interesting factor, the two people that saw this visitation were raised Catholics, I believe.
Moreover, you have a certain antagonism towards...
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, and in that moment, I had to really check that antagonism and say, well, yep, I understand that exists in me, but here's this grace. And so, you know, I don't reject Christian healing out of hand. I think there's many, you know, very good-hearted, open, wonderful people who are Christians, as I'm sure there are who are Muslims and any other Abrahamic religion you want to point to. But I think I don't reject the faith healings at all. What I what I find fascinating, Alex, is that every time, so there's no way I'm going to have a scientific, there's no data collection that's going to say, yep, that you were right, Simon, that was definitively, we ran that through the supercomputer,
yeah.
And that was definitively Mother Mary, there's no doubt about that. You've got your ticket, you know. That's just not going to happen. But what I find fascinating is when these curings occur, for example, the MS or any of these instances where there's a profound application of consciousness and somebody's physical being changes thereafter, the knee-jerk response from the scientists is, well, that's just the placebo effect.
Mm.
And I'm always left there hanging, and that's for them, that's an end point. But I'm always left hanging saying, well, hang on a minute, if we can do this without the billions of dollars spent on the pharmaceutical industry and all of the side effects that brings with it, why the hell aren't we pouring billions into studying this placebo effect that the scientists that already acknowledge exists and has a material efficacy in the world? It's beyond me.
Well, you know, that's such a brain dead approach that I don't even know if we can go there. We've pounded on that so hard, and that wall just won't come down. The part that I think is equally fascinating, but is just equally confounding as well, is when we approach it beyond that. So you get over the mind-body placebo thing, yeah, okay, there is some kind of this extended consciousness that we're dealing with, spirits, whatever you want to call it, and then they're somehow interacting with this, and then we're going to kind of begin to wrestle that to the ground. Then I think what I hear a lot of times is what you just alluded to, is that we get into some kind of psychologizing even about that other world, you know. Well, the spirits are out there, but they come forth and come in what shape are needed for the particular individual. The Virgin Mary isn't really out there. It's just the projection of that person's consciousness into the field of consciousness that then manifests this. Well, wait a minute. I mean, that's just pure. We're just making all that stuff up, too. You know, I just did an interview not too long ago with a guy, Raghu Marcus and David Silver, who are both were followers of a spiritual teacher that I feel a great connection to, Neem Karoli Baba from India. And so Neem Karoli Baba, he's back in the 60s, and he's got Ram Dass and Krishna Dass, you know, the famous kirtan musician, and David Silver and Raghu Marcus and these guys around there. All Jewish guys brought up, that's their education. He's talking to them about Jesus, right? And he's saying that the tears are streaming down his face as he talks about Jesus and how he says, you know, every Christmas I go to the church and this and that. So you got to wonder two things. So here is a guy who is a spiritual master, let's give him that, and he's corroborating the reality of that spiritual being. He's not, there's no projecting, psychologizing, any of that stuff. He's saying, no, that's a real, powerfully, super important spiritual being that's out there. It's a power. But there's also a certain playfulness of it that I think is, you know, evident, at least what I hear in the work with shamans and healers too, is that there's this trickster, playful kind of thing that, why is he bringing Jesus up to these guys who were raised in the Jewish tradition, right? It's kind of a twist, a tweak, you know? And they kind of see that too. So, you know, the complexity of this, I think, is fun and energizing and exciting. But at the same time, it's challenging because I just see so many potholes that we're going to step into as we try and figure this stuff out.
Well, as do I, and I think that's why my point of focus in the immediacy of making people's lives better with regards to the playfulness. One of the principal healing tools in the tradition of ayahuasca use is an ícaro, a magical song that has a different quality. It might bring with it you may not have a plant to hand, but you know the song of that particular plant, and this is not isolated to ayahuasca Corandelia small, but you can sing the Icaro of that plant, and that plant's doctor, its sentience, its consciousness, comes and applies what's needed to the patient who's being addressed at the time, yeah?
Simon, let me interject and make sure I understand what you're saying here. So you're saying that if in the absence of the plant, if the plant wasn't available or they didn't have it or whatever, they could invoke the song and it would bring forth the spiritual healing from the spirit directly.
Correct. And this is what I said at the outset. You know, there's this big focus, and this is an indication of this reductionist mind. What's the thing that makes us have the visions? It's the DMT,
right.
You know. But in fact, ayahuasca is embedded in this tradition of doctoring and plant doctors, and a curandero may diet with tens of different of plants, other master plants that teach through dream or however, and then they become part of their team, if you will, and so they can sing the song of that particular doctor that belongs to that plant that has a particular quality, or that celestial being that has that particular quality, which leads me to my story. I was engaged in a Huachuma ceremony in the high Andes. Huachuma is a cactus, also a strong tradition of visionary shamanisms in the northern coastal, the drier regions of Peru and into Ecuador. It's similar to the Native American church's peyote, you know. So I was in a Huachuma ritual, and you know, here I lean well away from any hope of recovery in terms of how we can quantify this scientifically. So you'll have to forgive me, but some spirits arrived and they gave me a particular Icaro, a particular song. And this is often how Icaros are given. They're given in by the plants or by the beings in, and then can be used later on like a tool that you learn or that somebody offers you, you know, a gift that somebody offers you. And they gave me an Icaro, and that ceremony concluded as it was to do. And sometime later, many months later, I was back in the jungle with a friend who often a colleague, a vegetalista, an ayahuasquera, and she often would ask me to do curings or sing in her ceremonies. And she asked me to sing, and I started to sing this Icaro from that had been given to me from, was specific to another plant and not really in the context of ayahuasca sessions, you know, but I sang it nonetheless. And these beings appeared and said, "We'll be there in 15 minutes. And I said, "Well, that's a little bit odd, a little bit human, a little bit bus timetable. 15 minutes seems a very human construct, you know. And I said, "Just keep singing. We'll see you in 15 minutes. And I watched, it was a moonlit night, there was no cloud, we're in a jungle clearing 50 miles from the nearest town. And
you're singing a song that you don't know from memory, you've never heard before, it's been transmitted.
Well, it's been transmitted, and I've sung it this one other time in that ceremony where it was given to me.
Okay.
And so in this ayahuasca ritual, the curandera who was holding the ritual said, "Cantar, maestro, you know, can you sing for me?" And because it was the moment, I chose that song that just arose in me. So I said, "I'll sing that Icaro from there," which was a kind of also directed or received, if you will. Yeah, it was just the arising of the perfect Icaro for that moment.
Right.
And I was singing, and as I said, they said, "We'll be there in 15 minutes. And I questioned this with my farmer's mind. Yes,
right.
Said, "That's a bit odd." And over in the distance, I could see a storm front coming. And we were in a clearing in the jungle. And I'm sure you can imagine the force of Amazonian rain. And I watched this cloud front move across the landscape at about a fast human jog. It was moving across, coming directly towards us in this clearing. And I watched it hit the edge of the clearing, and I'm singing. It was a moonlit night, really beautiful night. The moon was full, very, very light. And I watched it come across the clearing, and eventually it hit the side of the maloka, this thatched hut in which we were having the ceremony. And it was moving at this pace, if you can imagine, moving across the landscape, this wall of water at the edge of this storm front. And it hit the edge of the Maloka, and I turned to watch it come out the other side as I was singing, and it didn't come out. And I turned back to look, and there was a silver wall of water as the rain ran off the other side of the Maloka. And I looked up in the other direction, and it had stopped halfway across the Maloka. So on one side it was a beautiful, clear, moonlit night, and on the other side it was torrential Amazonian rain. And this process took, I don't know how long, a minute maybe, you know, of this cognitive disjunct. And the rest of the people in the ceremony realized it, and there was this collective gasp that went through the people that were participating. And then these spirits said to me, we told you we'd be there in 15 minutes, and the rain started up again and kept moving, you know.
Wow.
And these things are, how can I place these in any other context than human experience, than lived human experience, that had a profound impact upon me, that had a profound impact upon the other people there, and really can't be reduced in any way whatsoever, but nonetheless served a whole lot of people and that landscape really beautifully.
Simon, that's an amazing story, and maybe that's a good way to kind of wrap things up. And what is the future for you? Maybe you've just laid it out, is that, you know, I'm looking on your website, Quantum Life Bodyworks, and there's this just immense barren landscape. And it's funny, as you were saying that, I was thinking of somebody who's on a journey on one of these paths and just doing whatever work comes up on that journey. I have a feeling that that's what you are. You're out there just walking the path and letting it take you where it leads.
I think you're probably right. That image, actually taken just last year in southern Bolivia, which I heartily recommend if you ever have the chance, a magnificent landscape at about 4,800 meters. It took me a long time to walk to that cliff edge to take that image with scant oxygen. But this year I intend to take some Central Desert Nunkery, some traditional healers from indigenous communities here, to meet with South American traditional healers, indigenous healers in Tarapoto, Peru, if we can raise the funds for that to occur. And I would like to see more of that. I think that would be, if you ask me, what's my point of focus? As I said, the simplest thing that I can do is to help people. But if I can bring to greater understanding or greater awareness, greater audience, the richness and complexity and incredible sophistication of Australian indigenous curing traditions and cultural traditions, that would be immensely gratifying to me. So basically more of the same, yes, Alex, bringing some kind of, clumsy as it is, some kind of white fellow's articulation of the richness of these worlds that we've said are absurd, but are in fact very much the antidote to many of our social ills.
And Simon, if what you're talking about resonates with someone and they feel like you might be that vehicle to their healing, how would they go forth with that? How would they contact you, and what kind of resources could you bring to someone who was listening and was interested in pursuing that?
Well, you mentioned my website, quantumlifebodyworks.com. They can basically find me there. There's points of contact there, and there's some stories there, although I'm not a organizational capacity isn't my strong point, nor is web design or upkeep. But there is some media there, some stories and some resources that people can look further.
And what would they do? I mean, what would that be? What kind of services could you bring to somebody in helping them in a healing? What would you do?
Well, this is my primary role. This is my primary job. I'm in my office now. I'm seeing clients immediately afterwards. People come and see me on the table. We work together. I work around the globe in terms of non-local curings, and I'm regularly in Peru and elsewhere, Colombia, and in regards to working with those sacred medicines, with those plant medicines. So there's a variety of means and ways in which healing is affected. Certainly the most efficacious being, in my experience, for Westerners, most often those plants, the most miraculous. And so certainly that's a possibility that could occur in those jurisdictions where those plants are legal. And I should mention that those plants are prohibited in much of the world, which is why I spend so much time in Peru.
What is the legal status of those plants in Australia?
The same as the US. More restrictive because there is the allowance of ayahuasca use, for example, in the Unal de Vegetal Church.
Right.
That was a long-standing fight in the Supreme Court, and round and round and round. The Bush administration were very opposed to that getting through, but it did eventually get through. And as far as I'm understanding, they have the right to use that plant as their sacrament. And I think the Santo Daime is also under that taking that path. And as I mentioned earlier, the Native American Church has a capacity to use peyote in their rituals. And that's changing, you know, as your laws change. I think Australia's a long way behind any kind of change. I'd like to see a similar, in terms of curing potential, I'd like to see a meeting between those indigenous traditions in South America and those in Australia so that we could get some kind of legislative allowance for usage of indigenous medicines in Australia. But at the moment, they're all prohibited. The usage of them is all prohibited by law.
Well, it's been wonderful spending this hour with you. I certainly have enjoyed. I love the approach you have, and your experiences are probably something that we could fill hours with talking about. It's great work, and we're really glad you're out there doing it. Simon Green has been our guest. Again, the website is Quantum Life Bodyworks. Of course, you'll find a link in the show notes. Simon, thanks so much for joining me.
Alex, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I hope we can have another one sometime down the track.
Thanks again to Simon Green for joining me on Skeptico. One question I tee up from this interview is, what is the path forward for our Western culture's acceptance of these treatments, of these medicines, of these healing modalities, whatever you want to call it? How do we best move forward in a way that first offers relief to people who need it, and second, hopefully helps us understand what the heck we're doing so we can, in our Western way, replicate it and disseminate it as much as is needed? Although that raises the question of whether that should be done in the first place. So there's obviously a lot to pull apart there. Any thoughts you have on those general subjects would be something that I'd like to hear about. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at Skeptiko. Don't forget the K-O, where you can leave a message right there, jump over to the forum, send me a note on Facebook, or an old-fashioned email, whatever you like. I do want to remind you about my book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, and the many interviews that I'm continuing to do in support of that book that are over on the whyscienceiswrong.com website. If you enjoy the show, you might enjoy checking some of those out. Please feel free to do so. And also to the many of you who are emailing me and are coming to the show brand new and are enjoying going through the old archives of shows, hey, that's great. They're all available there from the website for free. There's the download links to all the shows. Of course, you can also subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, any other way you might want to get the show. It's all there for free I hope you take advantage of it. And do let me know. I love to hear people, even if you're going through a show that was a couple of years ago, you can start a dialogue on it and we can talk, or someone else will join in and join in the conversation of that. Everything old is new again, so don't feel afraid to drop me a note on an older show. Well, that's going to do it then for this episode of Skeptico. Thanks for staying with me. Thanks for supporting the show. I really do enjoy these conversations that we have together. That's how I think of them. I think of myself talking to you at the same time that I'm talking to these really cool guests. So thanks for joining me. Take care, and bye for now.